Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Australia Today's Parliamentary Library Lecture. My name is Jonathan Curtis and I'm the Assistant Secretary of the Research Branch. The lectures bring distinguished speakers to the library to speak on significant topics of interest to senators and members and the work of the Parliament. Today's lecture is titled Rising Inequality, a Stocktake of the Evidence. The issue of inequality seems to be one of the key themes of political discussions at the moment, and understanding the effects of different policy options on short and long-term wealth is both complex, and the resulting judgments are often disputed, I think. I'm pleased to welcome our speaker today, Jonathan Coppell, and a particularly warm welcome to, obviously, another Jonathan, a commissioner at the Productivity Commission. Jonathan will be discussing the results of the recent Productivity Commission's research. The report measures the prevalence of and trends in inequality, economic mobility and disadvantage across Australian society. Jonathan has a rather distinguished CV that I'm a little envious of. He was appointed as a full-time commissioner in July 2011. He's an economist with international and domestic experience advising governments on macroeconomic, investment, energy, social, environmental and regulatory policy, which is a daunting combination. Prior to this appointment, Jonathan was head of the OECD G20 Sherpa office. And I must one day find out what a Sherpa is exactly. And during his OECD career, he held a number of senior roles, and prior to that in Australia worked in positions at the Reserve Bank and the Treasury. Jonathan will speak for about 30 minutes and he's then happy to take questions. So please welcome Jonathan Coppell.
Thank you, Jonathan, for that introduction. Actually, the term Sherpa comes from the US State Department and it refers to the person that's basically the shadow of the President or the Prime Minister. It's a bit different in the case of an international organisation. And I was one level below, which is referred to as the YAC. I've got something to aspire to. So I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today, the Ngunnawal people, and pay my respects to elders past and present. Our report's title poses a fundamental question. Is inequality rising? And it's a question that draws diverse and competing views, and that's been illustrated in some of the media since the release of the report. Some in the community will come out and say, yes, it has risen based on this or that metric that they've heard reported. And others might say, no, it's actually fallen based on a different metric. And yet others will express a view solely on the basis of their perception of what is happening. And this is not a good place to start a discussion on inequality and its social impacts. For a serious discussion, it is first necessary to have an authoritative grip on where we stand today and how we got there. And this is precisely the modest contribution that the self-initiated research report makes, and hence its subtitle, A Stocktake of the Evidence. What we've done is to bring together and take stock of the latest and most complete evidence measuring the level and trends in inequality, poverty and disadvantage in Australia. Now, the report contains many insights, and some of them are quite different from popular perceptions. And what I'd like to do today is share with you a selection of those insights. Now, let me begin with some of the context and motivation for the study. As you know, Australia has clocked up an unprecedented 27-year period of uninterrupted economic growth. And this has prompted many to ask, how have the benefits from growth been shared? Now, this slide shows how sustained growth has delivered for the average Australian household in every income decile significantly improved living standards. And it's what distinguishes Australia from most other developed countries. It's certainly in stark contrast with the United States and the United Kingdom, which experienced much weaker income growth over the period. And this remarkable outcome also stands up to other ways of slicing and dicing income data, which we investigate in depth. Now, this slide shows the growth in incomes by decile in three distinct periods. But regardless of how it is viewed, decade by decade, or by periods of high and low investment, or periods of high and low productivity growth, it's only in the early 1990s that all income groups did not experience at least some income growth. But as we also know, income growth is not the same as inequality, and with such patterns of income growth, it is not clear from looking at this or the previous slide what the impact is on overall inequality. Not so with this slide, which informs one of our bottom line conclusions that inequality in Australia has risen slightly over recent decades as measured by the Gini coefficient, which is a standard measure of overall inequality. Now, it's most evident with respect to the distribution of wealth and consumption. The trend in income inequality is more contested territory. Now, here, the Gini coefficient derived from ABS data reveals a small upward trend. However, the HILDA data, which is in green, shows no trend change in inequality since the early 2000s. Now, one could easily get distracted dissecting the reasons for these differences, and it's important to do so, but this would blur the bigger picture. The key point is that just looking at the distribution of income in isolation gives you a lopsided view of inequality. A few examples help to explain why. We know that many retirees live on low incomes but have high wealth. There are also many young adults with higher consumption than income and relatively little wealth. And also, income patterns alone do not capture the importance of in-kind transfers from government, such as health and education and public housing. And this is why our approach deliberately eschews the specific and often self-serving use of any one measure of inequality. That we're bringing them together, invariably that requires some element of judgment in terms of providing an overall view, but this is the approach that we've taken, and it's on that basis that we've reached the conclusion that there has been a slight upward movement in the degree of inequality in Australia. There is another reason why commentary on income inequality is contested territory, and that's because the data reveals no uniform trend. It varies over time, and sometimes in quite unexpected ways. We were surprised, for example, to discover that the ABS data since the GFC shows a decline in income inequality. In fact, most of the uptick in income inequality over the past 27 years occurred during the mining boom period, when wages growth was strong. It's certainly something that surprised me. But it does remind us that growth is no guarantee against a widening disparity between rich and poor. Now, paradoxically, you may say that these inequality trends do not square with the perceptions of many in the community. In a recent survey, the Committee for Economic Development of Australia found that 44% of Australians felt that they have not gained at all from the nearly three decades of uninterrupted growth. Now, these views may reflect more on the real declines in per capita incomes in the post-mining boom period. So even though economic growth has been sustained, growth in per capita income, per capita disposable incomes, has been negative for four out of the past 5 years. Now, the reasons for this are not fully understood, but they are at least in part linked to the falling terms of trade and also low labour productivity growth. And this suggests that many Australians are maybe confounding the very modest increases in wages in the post-GFC period with widening income inequality. But regardless of the precise reason, they do indicate a risk of social fracture that cannot be ignored. And this again underlines the importance of first assembling the facts. Now, recognising the perception often is that the glass is half full. The most accurate picture that can be drawn from the data does suggest that each generation is still better than its predecessor. To reach this finding, we considered yet another way to look at inequality, and that is to dive deeper into the variation in income across age groups. Now, most often this variation reflects overall trends in the strength of income growth. Sometimes, though, some age groups have benefited more or less than others. And most recently, the incomes of young people have been aged up to their mid-30s have not risen in real terms over the past 6 years. But still, on average, the story is that each new generation has earned more income than the last at a given age and reaches the same level of income earlier in life. We also looked at international comparisons. They provide yet another perspective on the level of inequality in Australia and the scale of any increase. Now, this slide shows income inequality in Australia is close to the OECD average. We also know that Australia's wealth distribution is relatively equal compared to other countries. In fact, among 28 OECD countries, Australia ranks 8th most equal as measured by the Gini coefficient of wealth. And the fact that inequality levels are so different, as this OECD data indicates, among the developed countries, strongly hints at the scope for different policies, institutions, and political environments to shape inequality. Indeed, a further clear message from the data is that Australia's tax and benefit system substantially reduce income inequality. Relative to other OECD countries, Australia redistributes less income, but we do a much better job of targeting this redistribution to low-income earners. Overall, our progressive tax system and highly targeted transfer system lower the summary measure of income inequality by about 30%. So that's going from the red line to the dark green line. Government-funded services, such as health, education and public housing, which I mentioned earlier, they have an additional equalising effect. And when these in-kind transfers are included in a more expansive measure of consumption, inequality is about 30% again lower than that for household disposable income. So that's the light blue line. And this is simply because people with low incomes receive the largest amount of in-kind transfers. Now, there's been no material change in these equalising effects in the past 30 years. Those lines basically shift down. But there's nothing inevitable about them either. So up to this point, the inequality measures considered have all just given you a snapshot of the distribution at a particular point in time. And while they show a widening gap between the rich and the poor, that does not mean that the rich and the poor households at the beginning and at the end of the period are the same households. And the distinction is important and is why our report also considers economic mobility, which, if you like, is the gauge of whether the rich always remain rich and the poor always remain poor. And it matters because a society with a low level of mobility can limit the sources of economic growth and give rise to feelings of social exclusion. And mobility prospects are also an important determinant of life satisfaction and well-being. So how does economic mobility stack up in Australia? Well, there is good, there is in-between, and there's bad news. The good news is life course mobility in Australia is high. This slide shows those who were in the top income decile at the beginning of the century are now distributed across all the deciles. And 3/4 of the people in the top income decile today were not there 15 years ago. Now, we also looked at the movement from the bottom and the middle deciles, and a similar picture emerges. Here you can see the bottom. This is the middle decile. And in fact, you do the same, this isn't the Banksy picture, but it's not too different. Almost everyone moves across the income distribution through the course of their lives. Now, I'll give a few examples that I've picked out from this particular picture. So over a 16-year period, the average Australian was classified in 5 different income deciles. There were only 1% of households of people that remained in the same decile over the whole period. And there were 9% of the Australian population that spent time in both the top and the bottom decile. And it's life events such as transitioning from education into work, career advancement, household formation, having children, divorce, retirement. They underpin a lot of the movement in economic mobility, a lot of the trends that are observed in economic mobility. But policy design also plays a part. Now, I mentioned the in-between news, and this refers to another type of mobility known as intergenerational mobility. Intergenerational mobility concerns the relationship between a person's economic situation and that of their parents, and is a proxy measure for equality of opportunity. It's infected by the importance of factors such as family, wealth, connections, education, and inherited characteristics. Now, our report does not examine intergenerational mobility in any detail because it's more using the data in an analytical way to provide insights, and our report was focusing on the stocktake of the data as published by bodies like the ABS or HILDA. But we do cite some estimates from the literature, and these estimates suggest that intergenerational mobility in Australia is neither very high nor very low compared to other developed countries. And the literature also finds a positive correlation between income inequality and inequality of opportunities. So in other words, and contrary to the expectations of many, countries with a higher degree of income inequality are also characterised by less equality of opportunity. And this is yet another reason why the inequality story is such a nuanced one. Now, the bad news is we found life course mobility at the ends of the distribution. So looking at that ribbon chart, the top decile and the bottom decile, they tended to be stickier than those in the middle. And by stickier, I mean households in the top and the bottom income deciles at the beginning of the period were the most likely to be the same decile 15 years later. Now, that's of particular concern because low mobility at the bottom typically extends to beyond earnings to other dimensions of well-being such as educational attainment and health outcomes. And moreover, it may be symptomatic of low equality of opportunity. Now, to be sure, some stickiness at the ends of the distribution is to be expected, and that's partly for technical reasons. Let me try and explain very simply through this chart, which shows the distribution of income in 2015-16, with the colours representing each of the 10 deciles. So as you can see, the deciles are wider at the top and the bottom of the distribution compared to the middle, and the stickiness at the top and bottom ends of the distribution is partly due to this uneven spacing. So someone in the top or bottom decile whose income falls, say, by $20,000 may remain in the same decile, whereas someone in the middle of the distribution whose income falls by $20,000 as well will fall by 2 or 3 deciles. So that's part of the reason, technical reason. But still, the question is how much stickiness is too much? And a question like that, there is no consensus on how much matters, but international benchmarking does provide a basis for comparisons, at least. And relative to the United States, for example, economic mobility in Australia is higher overall and less sticky at the tails. And a similar pattern of income mobility also holds across a broader range of OECD countries. So our way of summing it up this far is that many Australians experience economic disadvantage at some stage in their lives, but for most of us, it is temporary. And for this group, sustained economic growth and reliable access to employment will continue to be the source of new opportunities and better living standards. But another group of Australians experience entrenched disadvantage, and they're stuck at the bottom of the mobility ladder and less able to embrace new opportunities. Now, disadvantage is a multidimensional concept, and it's about impoverished lives, not just depleted wallets. And our report tries to look beyond the standard metrics, giving weight to measures that try and capture the experience of those households in the bottom part of the distribution. Now, it can take the form of low economic resources or poverty, an inability to afford the basic essentials for an acceptable standard of living, also known as material deprivation, or being unable to participate in the normal economic and social activities of their community, also known as social exclusion. And we consider disadvantage through each of these three lenses. And this slide shows our estimates based on the relative poverty metric, which is the measure we use most in the report. And you can see there are major differences in the level between the various estimates. But in terms of trends, and with the exception of private consumption poverty, they have basically fluctuated around their mean. So despite 27 years of uninterrupted economic growth, unemployment stabilising at a lower level, and a significant redistribution of income, about 9% of Australians live on very low incomes. And this translates into about 2.2 million people. Of course, this number is a bit misleading. It includes many people for whom low incomes have an explanation that does not warrant a policy response. You know, I have in mind here students, for example, that are in part-time jobs, or small business operators that are focusing on building up a capital asset. And it also includes all spells of poverty, regardless of their distribution. And this slide shows the short-term spells in income poverty were by far the most common, with around 60% of people exiting income poverty after 1 year, and a further 18% after the second year. However, we also observed a high level of poverty reoccurrence. So of all of those people who moved out of income poverty over the period, a little more than half later fell back into poverty. Now, one factor that may contribute to frequent poverty reoccurrence is the higher precarity of the incomes of those in poverty. This slide shows that between period 2006-2016, for illustrative purposes, that people below the poverty line experienced more than twice as much income volatility year on year as people above the poverty line. Now, once you account for all these factors, the number of households that are experiencing protracted poverty shrinks, but still accounts for a significant proportion of the population. We estimate about 3% of Australians, roughly 700,000 people, have been in income poverty for at least the last 4 years. People living in single-parent families, the long-term unemployed, people with disabilities or other long-term health conditions are particularly likely to experience protracted income poverty. And for people in these circumstances, there is an elevated risk of economic disadvantage becoming entrenched, limiting their potential to seize economic opportunities or to develop the skills with which to overcome these conditions. And these risks are particularly elevated for children living in jobless households, which is a group that has stood out among the multiple measures of inequality and disadvantage. These are just a selection of the stories on inequality that we drew from the data and the multitude of indicators. Hopefully, they dispel the popular perception that the benefits of growth are not being broadly shared, but inevitably they do beg the question, can we do better and how? And our report does not enter directly into debates about what types of policy responses might be appropriate, but it does, however, provide pointers on where we could do better. And one such area I've highlighted today relates to the small yet significant number of Australians in entrenched disadvantage. Now, the issues here are multiple and complex, and there are few precedents. We do know a bit about the drivers in general terms. I've mentioned chronic disease, mental illness, addictions, long-term unemployment, poor educational outcomes are all associated with entrenched disadvantage. But more likely, it's some toxic cocktail of these conditions. We also know from evaluations of past efforts and analyses that policy designs need to be much more adaptable and targeted to individual disadvantage. And this is what the previous chair of the Productivity Commission referred to as handmade policy. But there's still a lot we don't know, even though we increasingly have the data to be able to improve on this work. And in this regard, one relevant dimension relates to the government's recent announcement of a Productivity Commission inquiry into mental health. Now, I'm sure that through our analysis and the processes of consultation, we will build up the current evidence base to identify where we can do better by our fellow Australians and make recommendations to governments on how to get there. Thank you. Now, I should say just before Q&A, I've put up the link to where you can download the report. There are a number of other documents on that page, including one which is basically a very, what we call the cheat sheet. It provides the executive summary, but it also gives a visual summary of the messages from our report. And I brought a few copies along, and I'll leave them here on a first-come, first-served basis.
Excellent. Thanks, Jonathan. Any questions? I'm guessing there must be some. I have some. So while you're... okay, just over to you.
You go first, if you like.
All right. I just had a question in relation to the geographical spread of those, because obviously they're, as I understand it, Australian figures. Mm-hmm. What about at the that kind of geographical spread, you know, rural versus regional... and so forth?
So I did say it's a comprehensive stocktake, but it's not an exhaustive one. And we didn't look at a number of other ways of cutting the data, one being geographic.
Yeah.
We haven't looked at sort of racial cut or a male-female gender-based look at the distribution of economic resources. There was some work based on HILDA, which was really on a state or territory level, and typically what they show is that it's the two territories, the ACT and the Northern Territory, that have a lower preponderance of susceptibility of the population to living in poverty. But among all the other states, it was pretty much a constant rate of poverty. Now, I suspect if you then dig down within a jurisdiction, which I think is what you were referring to, particular sort of economic areas of Victoria, for example, Western Victoria, there you would get much more variation, but it's something that we haven't looked at.
Okay.
I was interested if you could say a bit more about debt. So, you know,
debt,
yeah, so the media sort of reports that Australians collectively have quite a lot of debt and how that sort of influences the kind of things you're estimating.
So when we look at wealth, that would be abstracting from debt, so it's net wealth. It's an area where, as I mentioned, Australia compared to other OECD countries has a fairly equal distribution of wealth. Part of that, I think, is linked to the fact that we have a compulsory superannuation scheme, whereas other countries are still on a system first pillar, public pension. So those resources are included in the wealth concept that's being measured, and because it's compulsory, it tends to be across the whole distribution. Another factor is the high level of home ownership. So they are two, I think, of the main sources of virtually everyone's holdings of wealth, superannuation and housing. And because of that cultural attachment to owning your own home and the compulsory saving, which take into account the levels of debt, household debt, produce a high degree of equalness in the distribution of wealth in Australia.
Just the decline in relative income poverty and a slightly more equal income distribution since the GFC. What's driving that? Is it sort of the wages thing is pretty important, the low rate of wage growth, mm-hmm. and perhaps those at the bottom end are doing a little bit better with minimum wage growth and other industries that were formerly fairly low paid. Can you throw a bit more light on what's driving this decline in relative income poverty?
Well, I think you've answered your own question. The way in which distribution of income can change is many different ways. It can be sort of faster at the top and slower at the bottom, or vice versa. And what we've seen in the post GFC period is exactly what you said: the rate of change in incomes at the lower end has been faster.
Well, maybe I could rephrase the question. Why is the top end not getting very strong growth? You would think people in those deciles have got good jobs, you know, professional jobs, etc., but the growth in incomes there don't seem to be there as much as down the bottom.
It's a period where the economy has been adjusting to the end of the investment cycle associated with the mining boom, so there's been a big adjustment in the economy there. There's also been quite a substantial impact on the terms of trade, and you've got to also remember that incomes are a broader concept than incomes from employment, and it's those other sources of income that have held up relatively better than those coming from capital, for instance, which was one of the reasons why the top end has been pulled down at the top end, and which is contributing to a better or a more equal distribution of the incomes.
James?
Thanks,
Ian.
That's very interesting. You mentioned that Australia has a tightly targeted transfer system, but that also implies that we have a very steep decline in benefits and effectively a higher marginal tax rate as you move up. Do you think that contributes to the sort of income volatility and persistence in poverty of some households if they sort of can't get out of that welfare poverty trap?
So we haven't looked at sort of some of the questions that sort of come out from the data, but I agree with you. One of the implications of a highly targeted system is that the benefits taper, and as they taper, they can create poverty traps, which then is a reason why an evaluation of how those benefits interact with the tax system is required on a periodic basis. I think one of the possible other explanations for that poverty reoccurrence is the degree of attachment to the labour force is much more sporadic, so it's sort of in and out of work. That it could also be a factor. Some have pointed to casualisation of the labour force. We don't look at it here, but I know the numbers there basically pretty much are constant, so one would have to look more into that as an explanation to reach a conclusion, in my view. But what you've suggested is a plausible hypothesis, but not something that we've looked at.
Any other questions? Luke? The economic mobility that you were pointing to, particularly people going from the bottom up to the top, I think you mentioned something like 9%.
Yep.
From the bottom to the top.
Or from the top to the bottom.
Oh, okay. Right. I was just wondering, a lot of that mobility could be accounted for by, and I think you touched on this, people like students and some people who you might consider involuntary poverty or something like that for a period. But returning to their expected place higher up.
For sure. And it is over a 16-year period. So the longer you look, the more you're going to see in terms of mobility. We look at a number of other metrics of mobility, which then allow us to draw comparisons with other countries, drawing on OECD work. And some of that looks at a 4-year period. And again, that underscores a basic approach in this report to look at a multitude of measures to see what they're saying as a coherent message. And they reinforce that life course mobility is generally quite high in Australia.
I was interested in social mobility as well. So social mobility is about moving between deciles. And has there been, to get more upward mobility, you need more downward mobility. So do people ever ask about what policies we can put in place to encourage more downward mobility?
Well, distribution, when you look at a distribution, 10% is always 10%. So, you know, if 10% are moving up, there must be, there's a new 10% in the top, there must be an old 10% somewhere else.
So if we're keen on upward mobility, we need to encourage downward mobility,
then? It happens, as a matter of course. but that's in terms of a relative. That's a relative sense. You know, well-being depends on the living standards and opportunities and the quality of opportunity. And for that, there's no real necessarily a trade-off. I mean, I think that would be the more important point.
May not be politically very important as well. You've had your turn. Any other questions? Yeah.
You had a list of one of the earlier slides. I think it was countries listed by Gini coefficient.
Yeah.
I noted that the top five were English-speaking countries, and those on the bottom were the European social market economies.
Yep.
Do you have any broad observations or comments about that?
Yep, so the Nordic countries, countries that are characterised where high-taxing, high levels of income protection, and also education and health policies that ones that are well funded education and health and other community services. I would say that's part of the social compact, societal choice of those countries, particularly made in the post-war period. The case of Australia is one which you could broadly classify as sort of in the middle, maybe a little bit to the right of that. The thing that I thought was quite interesting was that the fact that the relationship between quality of incomes, if you like, it's the outcome, is associated also with a high level of quality of opportunity. But what it does reiterate is that, you know, it's not just something that drops out of an economic system. It's political choices matter. The design of the tax system matters. The design of the of social policies matters. And in Australia, as one of the slides shows, our tax and benefit system has a very powerful force equalising economic resources, whether you measure it from income or consumption.
Thank you. Just following on from that, this is pre shifts in spending, etc., in kind transfers? It's after all of that, isn't it?
Before, that's what I mean.
So once you factor all that in, then it goes, the Gini coefficient goes, for Australia, would go right back to that 0.2.
It may be the case for other countries as well.
So what does that chart look like post redistribution for OECD?
So this is disposable income, so it's after the tax system, but it doesn't
before transfers
take into account in-kind transfers.
Yep.
Now, there is a very recent report that the OECD put out, which I think is called Broken Elevator, Social Elevator, looking at just economic mobility. So it looks at multiple dimensions of the concept of economic mobility across countries as well. And it may have answers to your question about what does it look like when you take into account in-kind transfers.
Most of the analysis seemed to be based on ABS and HILDA data. I know they're very reputable data sources. Are there any known gaps or weaknesses in those data sources?
Well, HILDA is a fantastic resource. It's been around for a relatively recent number of years. So as that continues, the value that comes out of it will probably increase more than linearly. So questions of intergenerational mobility may be ones that HILDA will be able to provide more direct answers to. Since the report's come out, people have made comments about various statistical aspects of the report or what seems to be an anomaly between what the ABS is saying in the national accounts about overall level of wealth and what fraction of wealth we take into account. HILDA looks at households, that doesn't include people in old care centres, for example, that may bias the results. I mean, these are all valid questions, but our focus was to address the question: what is the sort of the broader trends that are going on in terms of inequality in Australia over the past 30 odd years? And these questions probably trying to get at a much finer level of much finer level of precision than what we have done for the purpose of what we're trying to do, which is basically to provide an evidence base or a fact base for a discussion on inequality in Australia and where it lies and how to respond to it, maybe.
Any final questions? Yes.
With regard to the in-kind transfers, you pointed out that everybody, that all deciles in Australia have had strong income growth in the last 20 odd years. And for one reason and another, and that's probably one of the reasons, there's been a shift to private provision in health and education, which would in fact increase the effect of the in-kind transfers on your Gini coefficient or your comparisons of consumption.
In terms of making the...
So the richer go to private schools. If you assume private schools are cheaper for the government than state schools, most of them I think are, then the shift to private schools would in fact result in an equalisation of your consumption because your subsidy to poor people would be greater than your subsidy to rich people. Am I making this clear?
Yeah. So we do have a... I didn't show it, but we do show a chart that comes from the ABS that shows the proportion of services provided in terms of health or education broken across the distribution. And you certainly see that having a powerful equalising effect for education and health. It may be that people at the very end, bottom of the distribution may have greater needs for health, so might be picking that up as well. The one area of in-kind transfers where you don't see that pattern as clearly, and it's a smaller one, is childcare benefits, which tends to be more associated with the middle of the distribution. But the biggies are education and health.
All right. I think if there's no more questions, let's wrap it up there. Thanks to you all for coming today, and thank you very much, Jonathan, for an excellent briefing and presentation and fielding all our questions. Please join me in thanking
And as I said, if you're interested, there are some copies of the cheat sheet.